Herzlich willkommen zu Krisendex, der Podcast rund um organisationale Resilienz, Informationssicherheit und Krisenmanagement. Von und mit Rico Kerster. Herzlich willkommen zurück zu Krisenhacks. Die heutige Folge ist eigentlich inhaltlich nicht so viel anders wie alle anderen Folgen. Sie hat aber eine Besonderheit. Ich habe heute einen Gast, der oder die sich in den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika aufhält. Und insofern ist das Interview in der heutigen Folge auf Englisch aufgenommen worden. Ich habe mich dafür entschieden, keinen Voice-Over anzubieten, weil das produktionstechnisch sehr aufwendig ist und ich davon ausgehe, dass viele der Hörerinnen und Hörer durchaus in der Lage sind, dem Interview zu folgen. Ich werde aber eine etwas ausführlichere Zusammenfassung am Ende der Folge machen und in den Shownotes werden wir ein Transkript anbieten, sodass man sich den englischen Text anschauen kann und dann auch nochmal eine Zusammenfassung auf Deutsch herunterladen kann. Warum habe ich mir jetzt jemanden eingeladen, der in den USA wohnt? Naja, das Thema, über das ich heute sprechen möchte, beschäftigt mich seit mehr als 10 Jahren. Es geht heute um das Incident Command System. Das ist ein amerikanischer Standard für Katastrophenmanagement. Und ich bin in meiner Bachelorarbeit darüber gestolpert, mehr oder minder strukturiert, weil das Incident Command System oder kurz ICS durchaus auch an amerikanischen Hochschulen verwendet wurde und ich habe mich mit dem Thema Krisenmanagement an Hochschulen beschäftigt. Und ich fand es besonders beeindruckend, wie modular das ICS ist, aber vor allem auch, es hatte eine sehr, sehr große einen sehr, sehr großen Teil an öffentlich verfügbaren Schulungen und das fand ich hilfreich, unterstützenswert und hat mich fasziniert und ich finde auch das ICS inhaltlich sehr spannend. Ich habe jetzt schon längere Zeit nach einem Interviewgast gesucht, der zu dem Thema referieren kann und bin dann auf LinkedIn über meinen heutigen Gast gestolpert. Sie hat sehr, sehr viel Erfahrung in dem Bereich. Ich werde sie im Interview dann auch noch vorstellen. Ja, Vorfälle wie die Corona-Pandemie oder das Ahrtal-Hochwasser 2021 haben gezeigt, dass die deutschen Strukturen, mit denen wir Katastrophen managen, vielleicht manchmal gar nicht so besonders effektiv und effizient sind. Ich will damit nicht sagen, dass die Strukturen nicht effizient und effektiv waren, aber ich glaube, in einer Zeit, in der wir in Europa immer weiter zusammenwachsen, in der Krisen auch immer größere Dimensionen ausnehmen und in der aufgrund des Klimawandels Naturkatastrophen eine größere Bedeutung bekommen und auch in ihrer Dimension größer werden, ist es notwendig, sich mit dem Thema Katastrophenmanagement vielleicht auch nochmal anders auseinanderzusetzen. Die Feuerwehrdienstvorschrift ist mittlerweile 25 Jahre alt. Es ist auch angekommen in der Fachwelt, dass man diese überarbeiten muss. Es gibt Arbeitsgruppen, die sich damit beschäftigen und ich wollte mit dem Podcast hier zum einen einmal das ICS vorstellen, aber zum anderen vielleicht auch einen Beitrag leisten, dass man das ICS vielleicht näher betrachtet bei den Überarbeitungen der deutschen Vorgehensweisen. Warum? Weil das ICS auch in anderen Ländern angewendet wird. Also es ist nicht nur ein amerikanischer Standard, sondern Länder wie Australien, Kanada, aber auch Brasilien nutzen das ICS. Es ist sehr modular aufgebaut. Es beinhaltet Funktionen, die im deutschen Katastrophenschutz aus meiner Sicht überhaupt nicht berücksichtigt werden. Und es löst eben auch die Herausforderungen auf, die man mit dem sogenannten Zweistabsmodell hat, dass es eben einen Verwaltungsstab gibt und einen Einsatzführungsstab. Das sind alles Themen, die durchaus betrachtenswert sind und die ich auch in der heutigen Folge betrachten möchte. Mein Gast, Brianna Haberman, und ich haben gesprochen über die Herkunft des ICS. Wir sprechen sehr detailliert in dem Interview darüber, wie das ICS funktioniert. Ein Punkt, den ich besonders hervorheben wollte, ist der sogenannte Unified Command, wo verschiedene Behörden vielleicht auch mit gegensätzlichen Interessen eine einheitliche Einheitsführung übernehmen und auch die Anwendung des ICS in der Praxis und die Integration von ja, Privatunternehmen, das ICS und die Verbreitung des ICS in privaten Unternehmen. Das sind so im Groben die Themen, die wir angeschnitten haben. Ich würde sagen, starten wir mit dem Interview. Yeah, today's guest lives quite far away from me. It's Brianna Haberman. She's located in Georgia in the United States. Her background is a bachelor's degree in Homeland Security and Emergency Management. She holds a master's degree in Organizational Management and Project Management. She has 20 years of experience in emergency services. She's doing consulting at the moment, as well as she's an operations coordinator in a county in Georgia, also representing fields of emergency management. Brianna, it's a pleasure having you here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here with you.
I came across a, for whatever reason, I came across a post of you on LinkedIn where you were talking about the savings for the FEMA recently and so on. And then your profile description says 20 years plus experience in emergency operation. I was always curious to have someone with like dedicated knowledge on the incident command system at the National Incident Management System in the US. So let's talk about that. Maybe you can give us a brief introduction on what National Incident Management System and ICS is, what the difference is, and like how it's mixed up, and then let's dig deeper into that topics.
Absolutely. So when it comes to the incident command system, and I'm going to start with the incident command system first, because really that is where it all started. And the incident command system was born out of a series of fires. They lasted over 13 days. The area that was burned, which is, while it is small for by comparison to the fires that California is experiencing today, was about, well, it was over 500,000 acres. That fire actually destroyed over 700 structures. 16 lives were sadly lost during that incident. And there was a daily cost, so daily, times 13, $18 million for that incident. After that, it basically came out, Congress, the United States Congress, mandated that the United States Forest Service develop an improved system. And so they received an initial allocation of about $900,000 that was invested in this. And what was formed was a technical team called FireScope. FireScope then really kind of drew upon the experience of war veterans, military command experience, and kind of developed two major components of the incident command system. Really, it's or I should say the incident command system and multi-agency coordination system. What that did is it really changed the scope of how major incidents are managed in the United States by creating a more collaborative approach to managing these major disasters. As you know, when you have a major incident, major fire, you are going to be working with law enforcement and fire. And it might even be, in the way it's set up in the United States, is we have areas of responsibility. So we might have 5-6 different fire jurisdictions that might be impacted by one large fire that stretches over what they call federal responsibility area, state responsibility area, and then there's a local government component as well. So you can imagine, with all of these different agencies being involved in an incident, how some of those agencies might have competing priorities, right? And how all of that comes together to form one plan of attack on how we're going to manage this incident to ultimately extinguish the fire or meet the priorities. Sometimes they will let fires burn because it's healthy for the forests, right? In some capacities. And so getting everybody into the room and at the same table to be able to coordinate and plan and meet the key priorities was abundantly clear that it needed to happen. I'll also give you an example of some of the problems that they had identified that prompted Congress to take a step up and act and say, you know, U.S. Forest Service, you need to do something and we need to figure out a better system for this. So out of that incident, Some of the problems that were identified were the wildfires did expose significant issues, again, in that multi-agency response because of competing priorities or because of different other elements. There was a lack of accountability, and there was no clear chain of command, right? Who is running this incident? Who do you go to talk to when there's a problem? So it was really unclear as to who had what responsibility and where. There was also poor communication due to not only inefficient systems, but also terminology that was conflicting. You know, there's all sorts of things. Like, you know, one thing that's real popular, law enforcement has a 10 code, you know, language here in the United States, where they kind of talk in codes. You know, 10-4 might be I'm all clear. And when you're saying that to a firefighter who's trained in plain English, that doesn't translate, right? Unless they have prior law background and can understand that. So there was conflicting terminologies. There was no clear planning process. So how are they actually approaching this coordinated effort to extinguish this fire? It's kind of just a free-for-all. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing that they're used to doing, and there was no coordinated effort. They also had difficulty integrating interagency type coordination, right? Because everybody's talking their own language, they have their own lingos, they have competing priorities. And then there was also freelancing, so individuals that weren't accounted for. One of the big things we have to remember is during the time of fire scope, a lot of fire departments were also still volunteer and or people would self-deploy to go help with this fire. If I gave you a little bit of history of the fire service in the United States, it was initially started, and in fact, it also impacts the fire insurance or just insurance in general industry. Folks would pay to have, they would pay people who came to extinguish the fires at their home. So back in like the 1800s, right? Benjamin Franklin days. A house would catch on fire and they would pay the people who came to fight it. Well, then, okay, if you imagine back then, a little history lesson here, these folks would get into an all-out brawl in the streets, forget the building that's burning. We're fighting because we want to get the money. So they figured out that, okay, there has to be some sort of a process here because now the structure that we were hoping to get paid for just burned down while we're fighting over who's going to get paid. So they developed a fire insurance program where individuals would pay a group of people and they would put a sign in their front window. And if they paid, that group of people would extinguish the fire at that house. So that kind of even talks about the development of, you know, the insurance system in the United States and how all of that came to be. And then the formation of fire departments specifically, right? So just kind of giving that mindset. And then also they had inconsistent management structures across all agencies. Again, every agency was responding for themselves and no agency fell into, they were responding just as the way they would normally, right? But on a major incident where it's interjurisdictional or it's across many agencies, the response might be different. They might manage it differently. And so there was no coordinated effort there. So again, those were some of the identified problems. Fire Scope was formed, which was a technical committee. They were funded and allocated about $900,000 for 2024 dollars. That would be about $7.2 million for that time, because this was back in 1972. And they developed the incident command system and the multi-agency coordination system. Then they started training people, because if you're going to develop a new system, you need to be able to train folks, right? People need to know how to operate in this system. And so it really started, took hold across Southern California, where they primarily experienced these major wildfires. They grabbed onto the system and started implementing it. And then the state of California, law enforcement actually grabbed onto it as well in 1986. In 1989, FEMA did start using the incident command system by integrating it into the National Urban Search and Rescue System. Again, very LA focused. And then in 2001, following September 11th attacks, it really also highlighted the need for a standardized emergency management system at the federal level as well. And so in 2004, Department of Homeland Security really developed NIMS. Now let's talk about NIMS. What is NIMS? NIMS stands for what's known as the National Incident Management System, and we'll kind of dig in a little bit later as to what the differences in ICS and NIMS are. But the development of NIMS really helped kind of bring a national standard to how we manage incidents in 2004. So it's still, if you think about it, it's only 21 years old, right? 2004. It's still not a very old system here in the United States by, you know, relative comparison. Then how do you get people to start complying with and implementing National Incident Management System and ICS into their daily operations, right? Well, the incident command system was then made into, a mandate, right? So organizations were mandated by the federal government, and guess what? Money talks. So a lot of emergency management functions are grant funded throughout the United States. Okay. And so what they do is they provided NIMS mandates, National Incident Management System mandates, and those mandates are tied to the grant funding that you can receive for emergency management. And so that's how you get folks to start utilizing this system and really start to breed the standardization throughout the field. So that kind of touches on the history, the origins of ICS and NIMS. Do you have any questions on that part of it?
I was just thinking, I mean, back in 2022, we had like a large flooding in the western part of Germany. And basically what you described could have been out of the federal report on issues of incident management. In Germany, we are also very federal. So a lot of local, like mostly local authorities, county level from your perspective is responsible, but you have also the state's level, your federal level, federal level is not involved in things. And basically all the problems you describe are somehow similar, and you basically gave the solution. So a large hello to all the people listening that have political responsibility. You also said how you can do it, like just fund people and support them, but also give directions on how to implement the system afterwards. This was pretty. I knew a bit of the history, but I think it's quite an impressive approach. And yeah, you said it's like 20 years, but as far as I know, even Australia and Brazil are using ICS nowadays. So it's somehow also fitting to other jurisdictions. If we talk about the structure of incident command system. Like, I have multiple questions, but let's start with, like, what is my understanding on this is, and I came across through my bachelor's thesis, so it's quite a while ago, but you have, like, great learning material online, so you can dig into that. It's you can handle basically any incident with ICS, having, like, a small fire, but also having, like, a national-wide incident where multiple jurisdictions are involved. So how does the structure develop? How is ICS built? What is the structural part of it? And how does it develop during an incident?
Yeah, so that is one of the most foundational and really components of ICS is the fact that it can be utilized. We always say it can be utilized for planning a party. Right? If you're just planning a party, a wedding, you can use the incident command system to plan that wedding. And so one of the things that I really want to kind of explain, and as I'm explaining this, I want you to think about if I'm holding a rubber band, and I don't think I have a rubber band in my desk, but if I'm holding a rubber band And that rubber band is flattened out because I've got my fingers all stretched out, stretching that rubber band out, right? What I want you to think about is as I take the middle of that rubber band and I pull it up, what happens? It's pointed at the top and it's arced at the bottom. Okay. Now, when in doing that, imagine that when I'm pinching at the top and I'm pulling up, this is my organization and I'm pulling up. And as it's getting wider, imagine that's all the resources that I'm pulling in from other jurisdictions around me. Okay. And that is how it expands. So to build on that and to kind of break that down, let's talk about how it truly expands. Okay. So if I show up at a fire and I'm the incident commander, and we have it written out in our policies that the first in assumes command. Okay. The only time that they hand over incident command is if somebody who is more highly trained shows up and assumes command. Okay. And that person then that was initially the incident commander, after providing a solid briefing, may fall within the structure and fill a different role. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But they will be, you know, relieved, and now they can go support, you know, the crews that are going in to fight the fire and extinguish it, you know, whatnot. So that being said, how do we build that out? Well, as the incident commander that arrives on scene, I see a fire that, you know, has it's well involved. It's possibly threatening other structures. I see that this, and it's got potential to grow even bigger. Okay. It's going to spread into the wildlands because we have wildland fires out here. I will immediately start calling for resources to backfill, because if you break down the incident command structure, you have your general, or you have your command staff, right? Your command staff is made up of your management, so your incident commander. It's made up of your public information. It might be your liaison officer. You might even have security in that command staff, just depending on what the needs are, right? You're also going to have your public information officer. So who's the face of this incident that's going to be providing the information to the community? Because the reality is, anytime I am running an incident, the public generally has an interest in what's going on. Whether it's the looky-loo that just wants to know what's going on, you know, the neighborhood know-it-all that's always involved in everybody's business, or it's a bigger, large-scale incident where everybody's going to be looking. The world might be looking at what's going on, right? We've had, you know, there's been articles from fires that I've worked on that have made it, you know, around the world, or even the near dam failure that I managed at the local level made nationwide, worldwide news. So with that, you're going to have the public information officer. You might even have a component of your legal advisor, right, involved in your commands part of your structure.
Just to my understanding, because like, from which authorities do those, let's say it's like a consultant, my understanding that the general staff is like a consultancy for the incident commander. So which authorities or jurisdictions do they belong to then?
So for this one, for incident command, just within the basic structure, okay, my organization, I'm going to give it to you on my county level. Okay. So I will be the EOC director. Okay. For this incident, I am going to work with my legal counsel to guide me. Let's say I'm having to do evacuations or something like that, or proclaiming a local emergency. They are going to be the individuals that are advising me on legally on all of the laws, so that I am aware of what my capabilities are, what I can do, what I legally can't do. That's going to be who it is. So it's going to be within my organization at that low incident command level. Okay. It will kind of talk about how it expands out into that multi-agency. You might also, so this is where you start building into jurisdictions. Okay. In prior counties, I had fire who, now this is kind of elevating into that emergency management level. So it's out of that field level focus, like I was kind of explaining. Okay. Getting into the emergency management level, I might have multiple jurisdictions brought together that are in operation. So my fire might be from multiple jurisdictions. Okay, but they're providing me intel and kind of providing that strategic support. So I'll touch on that in a minute. So as we're talking about the scalability in regards to the incident command structure, you also have your general staff, which is going to be your operations, your planning, your finance and intelligence. I'm sorry, your finance team, your logistics and resources, right? It's planning and intelligence. So operations, planning and intelligence, logistics and finance. Those are typically your four general staff. Okay. Now, as that incident commander, I arrive on scene. I have nobody else to help me run this incident, right? Well, now I need to get information out to the public because they need to know to stay away. So I need to build out. I need a public information officer because if I do not bring in help, who's responsible? Me. Okay, so I'm overwhelmed. I've got way too many irons in the fire. I've got to break some of this off and start delegating responsibility. So I'm going to call and say, hey, I need a public information officer to report to incident command. And then my public information officer is going to show up. I'm no longer handling public information. Public information officer is handling that. That's one thing that's off my plate, right? Then, I might need legal counsel, so that I'm going to call for them. They're going to show up. They're now handling anything that's legal related to provide me guidance, to provide me support, and preparing the documentation, whatever that looks like, right? So they're there to take that off my plate. Operations. They're going to deal with the evacuations, which would be typically made up of law enforcement in the United States. Law enforcement will do evacuations, but until they show up, who's doing it?
You.
That's right. So once they show up, I have now taken something off of my plate and they have a role, right? Now I also am going to be working with, okay, I need a fire suppression team and I also need somebody who's going to protect structures and the wildland from additional spread, right? Because I want to maintain this fire to where it's at. So I might need a few different teams for that, right? So I'm going to have a fire group or a fire branch, and then it's going to branch out into groups and units. And so the part that dictates kind of when you actually need that is one, are you able to accomplish and handle the duties assigned that need to be done, the actions that need to be taken right now? Are you able to accomplish that safely and in a well-coordinated manner? If not, you probably need to call for additional help, right? So then, as it starts to grow, there is what's called the span of control. That span of control says that, okay, the ideal, and this is based on studies, the ideal span of control for a manager or supervisor to manage individuals in a safe manner is between 3 and 10. The ideal is between 3 and 7 subordinates. So if you have a supervisor who now has, 3 to 7 subordinates, and we're going to go with 5 because it's a nice round number. Well, odd number, but we'll use 5. And so it's right there in the middle. So if I have an operation that's taking place and that individual has 5 subordinates assigned to them, and I still have a need for that similar type of operation, I'm not going to necessarily assign that to this supervisor's group, right? I'm not going to just keep throwing more people at this person because it's hard to keep track of. Fire grounds are busy, and things like that. So you want to then build another group. And so that's where, a strike team comes into play. So resource typing is really important, knowing what type of resource you're getting. And again, we'll kind of touch on that later on. But that's where you can kind of build it out. And so you can build that team by the objective that it needs to fill. Okay.
I just have one thing to point out, because I mean we have staff structures here as well. The idea here is you have an incident commander and the staff is basically providing him consultancy on decisions, and then those decisions are handed over on scene. Let's say you have like someone who's responsible for operation. It always goes through the incident commander, and then out of the staff it goes to a operational department. for you, the command staff, actually, so the operations manager in the command staff, he has direct reports that are doing operational stuff. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you said, okay, operations would be, for example, evacuation. So let's say operations is managed by someone from law enforcement, and then you need more fire extinguishing resources, let's say. Would you put them under the report of the operations manager who's from like law enforcement?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Now, depending on the incident, right? So my operations chief, again, this is where we have competing priorities, right? Let's say this incident is just a fire. It's a structure fire. You know, my house caught on fire and people need to respond. That is likely going to be run by a fire chief, okay, right? So my operations leader, or section leader, it's going to be dependent upon what resources I have available and their level of training. So if that individual law enforcement officer is not highly trained in operations and coordinating those efforts among operations, because remember, you're going to have your care and shelter. So the people that you evacuate from their homes, you need to do something with them. You have to provide them with basic necessities. Are they going to be out of their house for over 24 hours? Is this in the middle of the night? Do they need to get somewhere where they can sleep? Do they need food? Do they need water? What is it that they might need, right? So the person that is coordinating operations, you want that to be your most highly trained person. It might be the law enforcement officer is in charge of operations until a higher trained individual can come in to relieve them. And that might be fire, right?
How do you manage those competence levels on site? Like how do you know that the guy coming up has a higher education in ICS or higher experience in that? How is that managed in practice?
So that is managed through the training. There are standardized training requirements that basically say that by position, that these individuals have met this level of training and they are credentialed at this level. So that's really how
you're there, like you're on site or maybe you're off site already and you do manage your incident and then someone shows up. So he basically says, I know this is like ACS 103 or whatever. I don't remember the numbers in detail, but it's something like that. So I have ICS 103 and I say, yeah, please take over operations because you are higher skilled than the section chief at the moment.
That can happen. Yes. Okay. Yep. So now it just depends on, that's not always sometimes in those situations, we might put that person who is not as highly trained, we might put them as a shadow. Maybe they need to get that signed off, right? Maybe they need to get that checked off. But yes, the higher trained is going to come in and backfill. Now, okay, go back to I want you to go back to that rubber band analogy. Okay, you are wanting with your organization. So I'm going to take this on a much larger scale. Okay, I'm going to say we have ordered, 100 strike teams, and a strike team in the United States is 5 of the same type of resource. So 5 of the same exact type of fire engine, and 1 strike team leader. So you are getting a team of, depending on their staffing level. And you can be specific when you order this. Say, I need a strike team of 5 wildland type units staffed with 4 firefighters each. You know you are getting 20 wildland fire units, right? Or firefighters on 5 units. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then you have a strike team leader. That strike team leader is that supervisor for that strike team. Okay, so you are now pulling in all of these resources. You're building out your incident command system as you're pulling it in from all these agencies across the state and even across the country, right? Because they're all the typed engines. There's a strike team leader. You know exactly what level of training you're getting because there's a standardized requirement of training now that you have to meet in order to be able to deploy on a strike team. That's for California. And so you know exactly what you're getting. And that's how we really manage that component of it. So because you need to be able to know that these individuals that you're calling to your incident can operate safely, can integrate into the structure that you have built, so that you can effectively manage this incident and avoid that going rogue and people just kind of doing whatever they want, freelancing around, right? So does that kind of give you an idea of how you might expand it? The other method of expansion that goes beyond a span of control is when you have a large geographic area impacted, okay?
Let's say a hurricane, for example.
Yes, exactly. Hurricanes, for example. So you have a very large geographical area that's impacted. You can take that path of the hurricane and divide it up into divisions, okay? And then within that division, you can use a group and you will have strike teams and you will have, so that's how it really kind of builds out. So you can actually see the modular structure start to form out to build that pyramid of resources that you're calling in, right? So that's kind of how it works. I wish I had a visual representation I could show you.
I think for those that need more visualization, they should just Google it or go to the Federal Emergency Management. I think it's not an agency anymore, right? It's like integrated in Department of Homeland Security or something. But anyway, there are free courses to take. So I did this. I think you get a good idea then. Yeah. It's more to understand the concept. So I've more questions. One thing I really find smart about the incident command system or the national incident management system. Actually, I don't know the separation quite detail, but it's the idea of unified command having, let's say, you have like a, I think I listened to a podcast where they talked about school shootings, where you have like police, law enforcement, but also fire services, emergency services involved, and all of them have basically stakes in response. So they form unified command, which is a multiple agency approach, I guess. So can you tell me how that really works on the decision-making level then?
Yes. So when you have unified command, and I will use the active shooter type situation as an example, because when you have an active shooter, you want to get people to safety as quickly as possible, and you also want to treat the injured as quickly as possible, right? So you are going to have law enforcement who is going to be actively trying to, you know, secure and immobilize the assailant, right? So the individual that's walking through and shooting people, you are going to have law enforcement actively trying to stop that individual. But you also very rapidly need to get medical care to those individuals that are impacted. So you're going to have fire and medical working to get access to those individuals. Fire will go in with law enforcement, oftentimes in close tandem. They will have a law enforcement representative escort them into the patients, remove those patients, and get them to EMS. Or emergency medical services and get them transported and care as quickly as possible. So as they are competing, as they have competing priorities, but at the end of the day, it comes down to three primary objectives for just about every disaster. And you have it written out in your plans and it's well-trained and it's well-coordinated. The objectives are life, right? So preservation of life, preservation of property, and then preservation of the environment. And those are typically, in that order, the top primary on all incidents that you have, the primary objectives that you have for the most part, right? And it's also interesting and unique because when you have, to further complicate things, right? When you have an active shooter, law enforcement is also going to be very, very concerned about preserving the scene for evidence, right? Because they have their own investigation that they have to go in. And so what you do is you get all of these organizations in the room at the incident command post coordinating that these are our priorities. And at the end of the day, it's undeniable that the top priority is life safety. And so each organization falls into that structure under operations, and they are coordinating what those priorities are with a strategic approach. How are we going to achieve all of our objectives, utilizing unified command so that we all are speaking the same language, right? We all are operating in a fashion that's going to help us get our objectives met, and having overlapping authorities, recognizing that as well, so that we can collaborate under this one plan so that we can come together and achieve the objective at the end of the day. And that is life preservation, stopping the assailant, and then restoring and reunification at the end of the day. So that's really how it works. It doesn't work very well when there's egos, I will tell you that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I was thinking about. I felt it's like a more philosophic description saying, yeah, well, like basically the description says that everyone will have an interest to share the objectives with the others, because when you basically need the others for your objectives, then you don't want to get voted out, something like that. I don't remember, but that's basically what it says. But still, I mean, like, just to my understanding, there are, from federal level to a municipal level, different, let's say, law enforcement agencies that could be involved. So if I get it right, you could have FBI, you could have like highway patrol, you could have state police, you could have county police. Maybe you have like a small city which runs their own sheriff office with police. So all of them could be involved in such a scene, and all of them would be involved in incident command, or is it just one representative from law enforcement being a part of the unified command structure then?
No. So you would have all of those organizations involved. If you had an incident, you would have all of those organizations involved in that incident command structure, coordinating with each other. However, when you have that, how do you determine who's the incident commander, right? By default, the incident commander falls to whoever has jurisdiction over the incident. So we may have an incident that starts out as a local active shooter, right? But let's say now we've discovered that it was multiple events across multiple places, and we believe that this may have ties to terrorism. So now we're going to call in FBI, right? And we're going to coordinate. And now we are going to step back as a local agency, and FBI is going to now run this incident. They have the jurisdiction over this incident. So it's knowing where the jurisdictional authority begins and ends, and when you need to step aside as your jurisdiction and become a supporting entity. And this agency is now assuming that incident command role because it is their entity. You see what I'm saying? So it's again, it goes back to where the jurisdictional authority begins and ends.
I mean, that's what I think is like, how does it work if you have like a hurricane covering multiple states, multiple counties, and so on? So in the end, there needs to be one person to have decision on that. So will that always be the federal level then, or how does it work?
No. So actually, for widespread type of incidents like that, what will happen is every disaster begins and ends locally. And that's actually written through our Stafford Act. And so the local jurisdiction has the responsibility to support and respond to those emergencies. And by local, I will also be referring to the county. Okay. For us, it's the county, it's the city. And even within the city, the city has its own jurisdiction within the county, unless the city has deferred to the county to run that jurisdiction and provide emergency management for that jurisdiction. So you might see that sometimes. And it might be also you might have special districts in the U.S. where it's the Parks and Rec District. And it is a district that is formed by taxpayers who have voted in a board to represent them. So there are all these different levels, or we have levees out here in the United States to keep the rivers in the river channels and protect property, right? It's the craziest thing. We build these levees and it keeps the river in its channels. And, you know, so With that, we have jurisdictions that have reclamation, what they call reclamation or levy districts. And so those districts have their own responsibility to respond to an incident that impacts their jurisdiction. And the way that that is structured is, so I'm going to build this down to the lowest level. Okay. They're dealing with some of this right now in California, where they have a lot of rain that's coming through an atmospheric river that brings equivalent to the amount of water of the Mississippi River through at one time. And so those atmospheric rivers cause flooding throughout California, you know, the jurisdictions that it touches. So what will happen is we will have a levee district that has significant impacts from that event that has impacted their facilities. We will have a parks and rec district that will, you know, have an incident in that event. And this is kind of where we stretch into multi-agency coordination system. Okay, so MACS. And or it can also be referred to kind of, you know, like the emergency operations center. And so the city, if the jurisdiction falls within the city jurisdiction, the city is responsible for supporting that special district. Okay. Now the city falls within a county jurisdiction. So if the city has unmet needs or they can't get a resource or whatever that might look like, or they are all their resources have been exhausted, then they will go to the county that they fall within, and that county is legally obligated to support that city and that other jurisdiction within. Okay. So now the county, we have looked for a resource, or we have exhausted all of our resources within. We're going to go, hey, region. So we have different, the states are broken into different regions, and we're going to look for that resource within that region. And if, because most of these types of incidents when it comes to weather are impacting multiple counties within the region, we may not be able to get that resource there. So then we're going to go to the entire state, and we're going to say, hey, red flag, we are tapped for resources and we need help. And we are going to look for that resource within the state. Okay. And the state supports the counties and the regions. Then if the state is tapped, and you've kind of seen this in some of the wildfires in California, where we have to go outside the state and we have to go to our federal region. So we look at the region at the federal level and we say, hey, this is the resource we need. This is what we need. Is it available? And if that is tapped and we can't get the resource there, then we go all across the states, right? And sometimes we even go to other countries for resources. So it's wherever you can get the resources as quickly as possible to mitigate the situation as quickly as you can and get that whole area restored back to its pre-disaster state, or what we could call the new normal. And so that's how the system is structured as a whole and how we rapidly mobilize those resources.
What I wonder, still wonder about, is who does take incident command in such like large case, international forces from Canada or Mexico are involved. So who is in the end the incident commander for such a scheme? Is it still the one who started with the incident command? He might have been like working at the FEMA, and he's like very well trained. So he still takes incident command, unless he says it gets over my experience, over my education. So this is how it works.
That person is still in charge. And the reason for that is because let me kind of back up here, because now we're talking about an incident that has evolved beyond the level of that one house fire, right? At the field level for tactical response, that one incident commander, or they might bring in what's called an incident management team who assumes command of that incident. Okay. That's basically your entire org chart built out for ICS. And that's what these people live, eat, and breathe, because they have formed a team and that is what they do. That's what they specialize in. Okay. They may come in and relieve that incident commander for support if that incident commander requests it. The biggest and most important thing about ICS is that nobody self-deploys. That becomes a problem, right? Because remember, we talked about that freelancing component and some of the issues that were noticed. Well, if you self-deploy and you don't have that request to deploy, I don't have a job for you. I don't even know that you're coming to me. So, you know, what am I going to do with you, right? That can become a disaster in and of itself. So that incident commander, that incident commander having exceeded their capabilities, that's when the emergency operations center at the city or the county level will activate. If the duty officer who is providing the support to that incident commander, it's almost like it starts locally and it ends locally. So if you can imagine, you have an incident command structure at the field level, right? Then I activate the emergency operations center at the city level or the county level. I'm going to have a whole nother incident command system structure that's above that field level, right? Because I'm going to be leading by strategy to support the incident commander. And at this point, it might be multiple incident commanders, depending on what's going on, right? And multiple emergency operation centers, depending on what's going on. And that emergency operation center at the city or county level is going to be supporting that. The biggest thing I want to delineate here is that at that emergency operation center level, I am not telling that firefighter incident commander how to extinguish the fire, right? That fire chief or incident commander is requesting the resources that they need from me to support them in meeting the objectives that they've drawn out for their tactical approach. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So then as the incident grows at the county level, and we've expanded or exhausted all of our resources there, and I've now tapped the state, and I say, hey, state, I need help in my county. These are the resources that I need, right? Then the state may activate if they can handle it. They won't activate, but they may activate if my requests go beyond what they can provide as one person, then they may activate their state operation center. And then the federal government has a federal operation center. And so that's how it grows into this big organization. But it's all other emergency operation centers or operation centers are activated to support that local response.
So there is no, what I want to know is it's all bottom up actually. Huh? So yep. Like you build the structure top down, but then it's bottom up. How do you align strategies? How do you handle conflicting requests? So if you run out of resources, you have obviously to decide which scheme gets resourced and which not. So how do you manage that then?
So again, we go back to our core priorities, and we have to strategically identify how we are going to do the most good with the least amount of resources that we have, right? Or with the number of resources that we have. So we want to reduce the impact with the amount of resources that we have. And so we have to strategically identify how we're going to provide these resources. And that, again, comes into play with having law enforcement, fire, public health, our care and shelter teams, having all of those individuals in the room, because it's all of those experts at the table saying, hey, this is where the need is most. This is the most impacted area. This is where we need to provide the support, right? And so with that collaborative effort is how you will dictate who gets what resources. And the biggest piece of it is you need to make sure that it stays apolitical.
Yeah, it's just like I'm rendering in my mind, like, but okay, I think it covers a lot of problems that we face, because in our system you would have like different command structures from different jurisdictions. So police would form their own, fire service would form their own, the next county would form their own fire service, but there's no local component of that. So it's a bit different, and they can request, like what happened during the flooding was, they can request on their own resources from other states. So this cannot happen in your case, because there's always, like, you climb the ladder up, and then there's always a decision on priorities on each jurisdictional level. And then, so I think it solves quite a lot of problems. But what I understood, and I assumed different, is if you have a national wide incident, there's not one like large structure covering the whole country. There are multiple, but they are integrated somehow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so if you think about that, as all of the requests, okay, so it's also written into our laws, state laws, that if, so we have what's called the operational area concept, okay, and that is what I kind of alluded to before, but that is the official terminology for what I was describing, how cities and special jurisdictions that are within the cities, so political subdivisions within cities, respond to the city for support, and then the city goes to the county for support. So that clear line is threaded through from the local government, the most local government entity that you could possibly have, all the way through that line of communication, right? That chain of command, if you will, is threaded through. It's already written out. It's written out in law. It's written out in our plans on how that word is supposed to flow and get up to the state. So each operation center, if you think about, is a collection point, right? It's where we collect the information, we synthesize the information, we prioritize the resource requests, and what we can't meet, let's say we get 10 resource requests to the county, okay, low level. Let's say we get 10 resource requests to the county, and 5 of those we can fill. We're only going to send 5 of them up to the state. And the state is going to be the collection point for all of the counties that are impacted in that region, right? Or that state. And then the state is going to fill, you know, 25 of the 100 resource requests that they you know, receive. And the 75 are going to continue on to the federal regional level at their collection point, at their emergency operations center. So that's how you kind of, you know, build that threaded line of this is all one big structure, but it's multiple counties, multiple cities, and geographically it's widespread.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have talked a lot about the organization now. There are also other elements in it. Maybe we can just touch it. So it's planning P, I remember, which is also supported with a lot of documentation and forms and checklists and stuff. So just because like we took a lot of time for the organization, which I find also most interesting, but maybe you can just describe what the planning P is about and what those documents mean.
Yes. So let's get to the foundation of the planning P. The foundation of the planning P is about documentation. Your entire, at least here in the United States, your entire purpose for the establishment of your emergency operations center is actually twofold. It's to support the field that is on for the incident that's ongoing, but it's also to track costs and produce the documentation of the incident for historical purposes, right? So that we can learn from lessons that we've learned through this incident, but also because there's a funding component that's tied to it, potentially. So states in the United States may or may not have a disaster recovery assistance program, okay? The federal government has what's known as FEMA's public assistance program. So the activation of your emergency operations center is to produce those operational plans, but it is also to capture effectively the information that you are going to need for recovery. Okay. So ultimately, when you start with an incident, you have what's called, we refer to it as the 201s form. Okay. And I won't break down all of the forms on this podcast, but it's the 201s form. If you imagine the P, the leg of that P okay, going up the leg of it, is your 201s form. You will only fill that form out one time. That's why it's the 201s, not the 201. That is your description of this incident. You are going to use that form to provide your briefing, okay, to everybody that's coming into your emergency operations center and say, this is the situation. Okay, so that is your initial documentation of this incident. And you fill that form out. Now you have your briefing. All of your people have showed up. And you rapidly say, okay, this is where we're at. This is what's needed. Okay, everybody go to your positions. And we're going to develop objectives. And we're going to have an objectives meeting coming up, right? And you move through this planning P. It's a process that's designed to keep everybody on track, all of your sections in the emergency operations center, and to provide regular updates, to capture the information so you can keep your elected officials or your executives informed, to make sure that the knowledge is standardized throughout the organizational structure, to share with your organizational partners that you might be working on this incident with, who might have a different emergency operations center set up, that, hey, this is the contact information. This is how we're going to communicate during this incident. So it is a series of forms that will be developed by each of the sections through this planning P process. And like I said, that leg goes away. So let's say we are on a 24-hour operational period, okay? We are going to go in, we're going to have a set schedule of meetings for all of our planning meetings, right? And then we're going to have our briefings for the off-going shift. And the new shift is going to come on. And the development, this is the key part, the products that are produced as a result of going through that planning P process are not designed to simply document what I'm doing on this shift. You are writing the plan and objectives out for the next shift that's following behind you. Okay. So I always say you want to be nice when you're putting together your planning P. You want to make sure you can get as much done as you possibly can, so that your shift that's following behind you isn't like, what have these guys been doing all, you know, this entire shift? And they come in with a laundry list of things to do, right? And then that cycle just repeats. So that is what the process of the planning P is. It's to provide some structure, some organization to drive the information that you are getting for your incident to be able to support it.
Okay, got it. So. I mean, we didn't cover, I think we didn't cover the National Incident Management System so much, but maybe we need to meet again to discuss this. What I'm curious on is, to me, I like the systematic approach. Approach is also systematic, but we do not account for costs, for example. So I like the approach having like multiple knowledgeable people on site doing, like getting a good picture of the organization. And I always, like during my bachelor thesis, I looked at universities. So I came across some universities implementing ICS on site. I always wondered, like, how widely is it spread throughout the US? Is it used by companies as well? Is it something which is implemented all over the states? Or is it, I mean, you're talking about quite familiar, but maybe it's still quite a small community of ICS users.
There is. So ICS, again, going back to, you know, it's only been around for about 21 years, roughly. And, you know, so anything that is still relatively newer, I will say, is still in a lot of different situations, what we would refer to as foreign. It's big, bad, it's scary, right? When you don't know how to operate within the system, it seems so foreign to us. Now, here's the difference in ICS. And I try to simplify this down because there are businesses grabbing onto ICS. They are seeing how effectively it works and how it operates and functions. And so there are lots of businesses that are actually starting to grab onto it. However, I go back to the statement that I was saying, how it can seem very foreign. And the reason that I say that is because when you have chain of command, you know, in an organization, I might have a dotted line report to a different boss, right? But when I enter into that emergency plan, has been activated and I'm now operating within that emergency operations center, that incident command structure, my dotted line goes away. I'm not doing my day-to-day job anymore. I am 100% focused on this disaster. Our policies might change, right? From our day-to-day policies, we are now activating our emergency plan. So our procurement policies might change, how we go about getting resources, right? Because the entire intent is to be nimble, to be quick, to get the resources mobilized and rapidly moving into the system so you can build out that bottom part of that pyramid with that rubber band, right? So I can draw up my most highly trained, most politically and executive knowledgeable people who are knowledgeable about the real issues of our company or our jurisdiction, and draw in and backfill those lower level positions with highly trained people that are standardized. And so what I always say is that that other dotted line boss goes away. You report to who you are assigned to within the incident command structure, because the reality is all organizations are built on some level of an incident command structure. If you look at it, if you break it down, right, you have departments, you have divisions, you have, you know, task forces or teams that work on different projects. So it's all kind of the same in the sense, but you have to make it relatable from this structure to now this, whereas in an organization, the focus might be top down, right? You're receiving the direction from the executives. Now you are receiving strategic support for the field operations. And so that's kind of the two fundamental differences with ICS and your normal day-to-day business structure. And with that, I'll just kind of touch on the fact that, and we can definitely do this again, we can meet again. I'd be happy to meet with you again. But the incident command system is only a component of NIMS. NIMS is called the National Incident Management System. And NIMS actually focuses on command and control. Okay. So that is where the incident command system falls under, is command and control. Command and management rather. Same kind of concept though. Preparedness. So ensuring that preparedness is in place, resource management, that's where we talk about the typing of resources and standardized training levels, communications and information management. So how do we manage information's going out? And then ongoing management and maintenance. How do we maintain the system? How do we consistently improve? And that's really the difference between ICS and NIMS, ICS is nested in NIMS as a component.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe one last question.
Yeah.
Usually I ask for a like recommendation, but I'll do this afterwards because I think it's like, but I always experience the US as a like liberal, not from a political perspective, but from an economic, a very liberal society. So I wonder how and if you integrate, let's say, private companies in your emergency responses, like if you need forces that are maybe not fire services, but don't know, you need like large trucks or something, which usually fire services might not have. So do you integrate them, and how does it work? Are there like private-public partnerships? Or like how does that work?
So we have contracts with them, and we actually have private fire companies that specifically come out for wildfires. And they will form strike teams. So we just form agreements with these organizations. We try to do so pre-disaster. That doesn't always happen. But for example, I'll give you an incident where we had levees breaking all over our county one time. And we had, within a matter of just a few hours, we had 200 rock trucks delivering rock. And I'm talking base rock, 3/4, you know, riprap, all sorts of rock being delivered, 200 trucks in 24 hours round the clock, okay, within just a few hours. We tap our contract resources, and sometimes that means going out and forming a contract in time. So rapidly getting the information that we need to make sure that we can expediently get this these resources activated and mobilized. And so the reality is we definitely integrate with them. We typically are going to go with those who are familiar with working in the incident command system structure, or we provide them with a just-in-time training. And because the resources, at the end of the day, it's how can we get the resources here quickly enough?
So this is actually what I was wondering about. So you would basically, there are companies out there who have a training on ICS, and then you would say you're my strike leader or whatever, supervisor for that operation. You're the truck operation supervisor or no?
No, because they're going to ultimately they're going to report to the strike team leader that we might have. So we'll assign somebody as a strike team leader. They're going to check in and check out with our incident command post. Okay. And provide those resources, or they're going to follow direction as to where they need to go. It may be a staging site offsite, right? If it's not safe for them to get in there, it's going to be a staging site offsite where we are then going to get the resources to truck that in and perform the work. So it's not necessarily an ICS is not necessarily a requirement. It's a perk, but it's not necessarily a requirement for them to, you know, to be utilized, to be tapped. Because a lot of organizations may not have ICS training. Mm-hmm.
But there are. I wonder, there are organizations who obviously have training. So it's also something we don't really use. So getting companies familiar with our command structures. Actually, it was pretty interesting. I would have loved to talk longer. So yes. If I can come back to you, I think we need to do another talk on those things. Because I like the comparison. And I think you... Like, first, I understand your job is quite has quite a wide spread of things, and it's like a lot of responsibility, actually, being an emergency manager in the U.S., handling all these things. So it's, I like the concept. I really appreciated how you described all the stuff to me so I could understand. I hope the listeners can do as well. And, yeah, I really thank you for being here.
Oh, 100%. You ever need anything, do not hesitate to reach out. I'm happy to help. I always, you know, I've lived, like I said, I've lived, eaten, and breathed this incident command system structure. And it fascinates me too. You know, I think part of what is so cool about the structure is that you're really building a structure that has never existed before and is never going to exist again, because it's going to be different for every disaster, right? But it's using the same concepts. And so I'm always happy to help those, you know, that are interested in learning about it. So anything I can do to help, just don't hesitate to reach out.
Yeah, one can feel that you love it. Thank you so much.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Ja, soweit mein durchaus aufschlussreiches und interessantes Interview mit Brianna Haberman. Was kann man mitnehmen aus dem Interview, was jetzt doch länger war, als ich es geplant habe, aber ich fand die Themen so spannend, dass ich nicht unterbrechen wollte. Zum einen, dass die Probleme, die wir in Deutschland strukturell sehen, vielleicht auch insbesondere als Ergebnis des Ahrtal-Hochwassers jetzt keinesfalls einzigartig sind, sondern dass viele der Probleme, die dort thematisiert werden in den Auswertungen, auch in den USA schon bekannt waren, nur halt etliche Jahrzehnte früher. Ja, fehlende Koordination, untere Zuständigkeiten, schlechte Kommunikation, das sind alles Themen, die man durchaus auch mitnehmen kann, die ja im Ahrtal ja, mehr oder minder auch eine Rolle gespielt haben. Persönlich würde ich sagen, wenn man sich anschaut, wie Stabstrukturen in Großschadenslagen entstehen in Deutschland, dann ist das durchaus schon auch eher ineffizient und da kann man, glaube ich, hier einiges lernen. Der zweite Punkt ist, dass das ICS aus meiner Sicht sehr, sehr klare Rollen und Zuständigkeiten beinhaltet. Die erste eintreffende Führungskraft ist eben der Incident Commander. Und der bleibt es so lange, bis jemand mit höherer Qualifikation übernimmt. Wir haben in Deutschland sicherlich auch Strukturen, die sind aber nicht so klar. Im Zweifelsfall ist es eben, und wir haben das gesehen, vor einigen Wochen gab es einen Verkehrsunfall in der Nähe des Tesla-Werks. Da ist dann die öffentliche Feuerwehr zuständig. Es gab dann Kritik an der Werkfeuerwehr, die dort gar keine Zuständigkeit hat. Selbst wenn sie zuständig gewesen wäre, dann ist der Einsatzleiter der Werkfeuerwehr nur so lange Einsatzleiter, bis jemand aus der öffentlichen Feuerwehr übernimmt. Also es gibt durchaus Schnittstellenbereiche, wo wir hier ja, Einsatz- oder Verantwortungsübernahmen haben. Und ich finde es sehr spannend, dass es dort in den USA relativ klar gelöst ist und dass vor allem bei interdisziplinären Einsätzen eine einzige Einsatzführung etabliert wird. Also man hat hier Feuerwehr, man hat Polizei, Staatsanwaltschaft und so weiter, alle unter einem Führungssystem und der Verwaltungsstab, wie wir ihn in Deutschland kennen, der wird gleich mit integriert, sodass man also auch eine Kostenallokation innerhalb des ICS hat. Das finde ich sehr, sehr spannend und ich glaube, das ist etwas, was man durchaus auch in Deutschland überlegen sollte und überlegen könnte, hier die Strukturen deutlich stärker zusammenzuführen und zu vereinheitlichen. Ja, ein dritter Aspekt, den ich bewundernswert finde und wo das ICS, glaube ich, Antworten gibt auf Fragen, die wir hier auch haben, ist die Multi-Agency Coordination und der Unified Command. Unified Command eben mit der Idee, dass man mit einer einzigen Strategie spricht, behördenübergreifend. Ja, wir haben das bei einem Active Shooter Event diskutiert. Da haben wir eben Aspekte, die Polizei, die Feuerwehr, aber die auch Rettungsdienst betreffen. Und hier werden eben gemeinsame Entscheidungen getroffen und vor allem werden die Ressourcen eben gemeinsam allokiert. Und es ist eben relativ klar, dass unabhängig davon, wo der Incident Commander final herkommt, dass man mit einer einheitlichen Einsatzführung spricht. In Deutschland haben wir, wenn wir über sowas sprechen, durchaus vielleicht gar nicht auf der gleichen Ebene, aber durchaus ebenenübergreifend miteinander, nebeneinander existierende Strukturen und anekdotische Evidenz ist es eben so, dass beim Ahrtal-Hochwasser das THW in Amtshilfe für Kommunen tätig war, wo es beim Landkreis schon gar nicht mehr angesiedelt war, aber alle im gleichen Ort am Ende irgendwie tätig waren, sodass man also mit dem gleichen Schadensobjekt unterschiedliche Zuständigkeiten hatte, je nachdem, aus welcher Verwaltungsebene jetzt hier die Einsatzführung kam. Und leider ist ja das Thema Messerangriffe aktuell in Deutschland ein relativ präsentes in den Medien. Das ist wahrscheinlich vergleichbar mit einem Active Shooter Event und vielleicht können wir da einfach lernen, wie man ebenenübergreifend sachgerecht und zielgerecht Einsatzführung gestalten kann. Dann ist das ICS sehr, sehr skalierbar. Man kann es eben vom kleinen lokalen Einsatz bis hin zu Hurricanes oder Terroranschlägen skalieren. Die Struktur bleibt gleich, die Anzahl der Akteure wächst. Wir haben, oder Brianna hat das Bild eines elastischen Bandes genommen, was man eben nach oben zieht. Und die Integration ist sehr, sehr dynamisch möglich. Also je nachdem, welche Fachverantwortungen, welche Einsatzkräfte ich brauche, sind die sehr modular in das ICS integrierbar. Die Stabsstruktur ist jetzt im Zweifelsfall gar nicht so anders, als sie das bei der Feuerwehrdienstvorschrift ist, aber der wesentliche Unterschied ist eben, dass zum Beispiel Operations oder Logistics im ICS direkt Einsatzkräfte steuern und führen und insofern eben auch ja, die Einsatzführung deutlich direkter erfolgt, als das bei uns ist, wo der Stab dann im Zweifelsfall in rückwärtigen Führungsebenen sitzt und dann in die Einsatzführungsstrukturen zurückgibt und der Einsatzleiter die Letztverantwortung trägt, hat man hier eben eine klare Aufteilung innerhalb des Stabes und hat eben auch die Möglichkeit, zum Beispiel ja Operations, was vielleicht vergleichbar mit dem S3 ist, so auszugestalten, wie es eben lagespezifisch notwendig ist. Und wenn es jetzt eine Lage ist, die eher polizeilastig ist, dann nimmt man vielleicht hier als Section Chief jemanden, der aus dem Polizeihintergrund kommt. Wenn es eine große Katastrophenschutzlage ist, dann passt man das entsprechend an. Das finde ich sehr smart und das hilft eben in der Modularisierung. Im Vergleich zu Deutschland wäre es ja so, dass wir im Zweifelsfall zwei völlig autarke Stäbe hätten. Einen bei der Polizei, einen bei der Feuerwehr, sodass eben hier die Strukturen auch gar nicht so tief ineinander integrierbar wären. Ja, dann haben wir gesprochen über den Prozess an sich und die Dokumentation, die entsteht, die hat ja nach Briannas Erzählungen vor allem zwei Ziele. Zum einen Kostenkontrolle und aber zum anderen eben auch eine Dokumentation, die vor allem für die nachfolgenden Einsatzführungsschichten, Einsatzführer relevant sind. Ich fand es sehr, sehr interessant, dass das Thema Klagen oder wie man sagen, Haftung gar nicht so eine große Rolle gespielt hat, obwohl das zumindest vielleicht für mich auch nochmal ein Bild ist, was aus den USA durchaus geprägt ist. Ja, also diese hohen Schadenssummen nach irgendwelchen Klagen zivilrechtlicher Art, wenn sich jemand Kaffee über den Schoß gekippt hat. Das kam jetzt hier gar nicht so stark raus. In Deutschland nehme ich dazu oder im Vergleich dazu das häufiger wahr, dass man sagt, ja, man ist ja mit einem Bein im Gefängnis. Das schien mir jetzt hier nicht so eine große Rolle zu spielen, kann natürlich auch einfach an Brianna liegen, aber ich hatte nicht das Gefühl, dass es bei der Dokumentation um Gerichtsfestigkeit geht, sondern tatsächlich einfach um eine gegenseitige Planbarkeit und am Ende auch eine Kostenkontrolle, eine sachgerechte Kostenallokation. Im Zentrum des Ganzen steht das Planning P. Ich habe im Interview gesagt, man kann es googeln. Ich werde die Informationen auch nochmal in den Shownotes verlinken, sodass man sich das angucken kann. Hier werden die Informationen in einem strukturierten Prozess gesammelt und es gibt verschiedene Besprechungsebenen und Dokumentationsformate, die man dann nutzen kann. Und das lässt sich, so entsteht eben die Dokumentation aus der Lage heraus. In Deutschland ist es so, dass wir den Führungsvorgang haben, der Führungsvorgang aber aus meiner Sicht eher ein Denkmodell als ein strukturierter Entscheidungsprozess ist. Er ist schon ein strukturierter Entscheidungsprozess, aber er bietet eben nicht den Komfort, dass die Dokumentation quasi in diesem Prozess mit entsteht und das Thema Kostenkontrolle spielt in den meisten Stäben überhaupt keine Rolle. Es gibt nicht mal ein Sachgebiet für das Thema Kosten. Das ist, wenn, dann sekundär relevant. Sicherlich kann man das Ganze, wenn es um Lagebilder geht oder Entscheidungsprozesse mit Software unterstützen, aber ich denke, dass ein Prozess wie das Planning P das noch viel, viel einfacher machen würde, weil ja, eben völlig klar ist, wie die Dokumentation in einer Software aussehen muss, wo hier zulande dann eben durchaus der Softwareanbieter doch auch noch die Chance hat, da vielleicht sein USP zu setzen. Man merkt, ich tendiere da eher sozusagen in die eine Richtung. Ich will das aber am Ende gar nicht werten, sondern sagen, das ist vor allem ein, ja, einfach ein Unterschied. Was wir dann noch gelernt haben, ist, dass private Unternehmen in den USA aktiv in den Katastrophenschutz eingebunden werden. Es gibt Verträge mit Logistikunternehmen, es gibt spezialisierte Feuerwehrunternehmen, die im Zweifelsfall in der Waldbrandbekämpfung eingesetzt werden. Es gibt Infrastrukturunternehmen, die dort eingesetzt werden. Manche von denen sind dann eben sogar kompetent in der Anwendung des ICS. Das ist etwas, was wir, glaube ich, hier deutlich stärker lernen können. Ich würde sagen, mir erschließt sich nicht, warum jeder Landkreis sich Sandsäcke in ein Lager packen muss, wenn es in jedem Landkreis wahrscheinlich 15 Unternehmen gibt, die eine Lagerhalle haben, die Bagger haben, die LKWs haben und die genauso gut oder vielleicht sogar viel besser als Ehrenamtliche Sandsäcke zu Einsatzstellen bringen könnten und die vielleicht sogar dann auch noch über die Kompetenz verfügen, relativ schnell relativ viele Leute, die die entsprechend notwendige Kompetenz oder Ausdauer mitbringen, solche Sandsäcke zu füllen, einzubinden. Was notwendig ist, ist, dass die Unternehmen die Führungssysteme verstehen. Dafür müssen diese Führungssysteme aber dann eben auch übergreifend relativ standardisiert sein. Da darf an der einen Landkreisgrenze dann nicht Schluss sein, wenn ich ein Unternehmen aus dem nächsten Landkreis holen will. Ja, wie gesagt, so Private-Public-Partnerships, das ist was, wo es, glaube ich, einen inhaltlichen Konsens in der Fachcommunity gibt, was ich aber in der Praxis überhaupt nicht wahrnehme und wo wir, glaube ich, auch sehr, sehr viel Geld in Spezialressourcen investieren, die an anderer Stelle viel weniger ressourcenintensiv investiert werden könnten. Ja, dann haben wir gesprochen über Ausbildung und Zertifizierungen. Die Ausbildung für Incident Commander ist in den USA im gesamten Land standardisiert. Es gibt die Federal Emergency Management Agency, die das steuert. Da gibt es eine Akademie, man kann da Online-Kurse machen. Es gibt Zertifizierungen. Je nach Seniorität und Zertifizierungsstufe ist man eben auch mehr oder weniger geeignet, Einsatzführung an bestimmten komplexen Schadenslagen zu übernehmen. Jetzt will ich sagen, gut, wir haben natürlich in Deutschland zum Beispiel die Feuerwehrdienstvorschrift 2, die das auch deutschlandweit regelt. Ich würde aber sagen, dass inhaltlich die Ausbildung sicherlich nicht an allen 16 Landesfeuerwehrschulen gleich ist. An allen 17 Polizeischulen sicherlich nicht. Ich weiß nicht, wie es beim THW ist. Ich weiß nicht, wie es beim Deutschen Roten Kreuz ist. Aber am Ende haben natürlich all diese Ausbildungswege Nuancen. Und das Interessante ist ja auch, dass Brianna jetzt im Spezifischen einen Job hat, wo sie Emergency Manager ist. Das heißt, sie ist im Zweifelsfall auch eingesetzt für die Einsatzleitung. Ja, das kennen wir. Wir haben Kreisbrandmeister oder Kreisbrandinspektoren, die eine solche Funktion übernehmen. Aber ich glaube, man kann hier mit so einer Art Kompetenzreserve und einer standardisierten Ausbildung durchaus vielleicht auch unterstützen, weil man die Kompetenz, einen Einsatz zu führen, auf einer ganz abstrakten Ebene relativ unabhängig von der lokalen Kompetenz ist. Und ich denke, da kann man viel von lernen. Vor allem kann man auch lernen, wie man solche Formate bereitstellt. Und da muss man sich vielleicht gar nicht streiten, wann denn dann die Bundesakademie für Zivilschutz und Katastrophenhilfe irgendwann in Norddeutschland fertig ist, wenn man das vielleicht schafft, hier eben Ausbildungs- und Prüfungsformate auch online anzubieten. Und zu guter Letzt möchte ich nochmal hervorheben, weil ich es einfach so klug und effizient fand, die Frage, wie ist denn eigentlich das ICS so bekannt geworden oder in den USA zum Standard geworden? Indem man es zum Beispiel mit staatlicher Förderung verknüpft hat. Also das ist ja so trivial, wie es ist, eine Idee, die man durchaus auch hier mal nachverfolgen könnte, dass man sagt, na gut, wir verknüpfen einfach die Übergabe von, was weiß ich, eine Bundesbeschaffung eines Fahrzeugs eben mit der Verpflichtung, auch die bundeseinheitlichen Führungsmodelle anzuwenden. Ansonsten kann dort vielleicht eine Kommune, ein Landkreis gar nicht mitmachen. Und das finde ich dann doch relativ klug und einfach, ohne vielleicht hier auch eine große Föderalismusreform machen zu müssen. Ich sehe insofern das hier nicht. Und dann vielleicht noch zu guter Letzt, wir haben im Interview darüber gesprochen, die Entwicklung des ICS war ja eine Aufgabe, die die Vereinigten Staaten angegangen sind, die dann vor allem, also die insgesamt 7,2 Millionen Dollar gekostet hat. Jetzt muss man sagen, naja, ist es jetzt viel oder wenig Geld? Also der Forschungsetat des BBK beträgt irgendwie 2 Millionen Euro. Man kann jetzt natürlich fragen, muss man denn sowas von Grunde auf entwickeln, wenn es hier in den USA doch schon was gibt, wo man aufsetzen kann? Und wenn wir ja auch, und da verweise ich auf die Folge mit Jan Seitz, in Deutschland schon relativ viel Forschung betrieben haben im Grundlagenbereich, vielleicht könnte man mit den 2 Millionen Euro dann vielleicht auch ein deutschlandweites Standardverfahren entwickeln. Aber ich finde auch die 7,2 Millionen Euro im Vergleich zu den Summen, die aktuell zur Bundestagswahl in ganz anderen Kontexten genannt werden, jetzt nicht überragend viel. Man merkt also, wenn ein Wille da wäre, könnte man relativ effizient und pragmatisch vorgehen und die Strukturen intensivieren. Ich nehme es leider im gesamten Bundestagswahlkampf nicht wahr, dieses Thema. Ich nehme auch unterhalb der Ebene der Top-Politiker keine große Diskussion darüber wahr. Gleichzeitig glaube ich, dass in einer Zeit, in der Krisen immer häufiger werden, Krisen sich überlagern, Stichwort Polykrise, und wir mit den steigenden Herausforderungen des Klimawandels zu kämpfen haben werden, gar nicht umherkommt, als effizientere und effektive Strukturen zu schaffen. Ja, soweit die Folge dieses Mal. Ich freue mich, wenn Sie hier so lange dran geblieben seid. In den Shownotes gibt es, wie gesagt, nochmal einen Link zu einer Transkription des Interviews mit einer Übersetzung. Und ich freue mich weiterhin über Feedback, Anregungen und Vorschläge, gern per Privatnachricht auf LinkedIn, dort heiße ich, wie ich heiße, Rico Kerstan, oder über die E-Mail redaktion@krisenhex.de. Wir hören uns in 14 Tagen wieder. Dann ist die Bundestagswahl auch gelaufen. Vielleicht ergibt sich ja in den letzten Tagen bis zur Wahl doch noch ein Wunder und das Thema kommt aufs Tableau. Bleiben wir also gespannt. Bis dahin, auf Wiederhören.